So this is, let's see, week four. This is a short course. We only have 6 weeks, rather. Next week we finish this chapter, and then in a bold move for week six, we do all of chapter four, which is fairly short. This chapter, it's maybe a little artificial to stop it in the middle. Because the theme is really important, this idea of returning to the nameless. But I think what we can do, which is the chapter title, that's the title of the chapter as a whole. But I think what we can really accomplish today is try to get more clear, very clear, on what is this nameless. So that's a little paradoxical, isn't it? Because if you could name the nameless, it wouldn't be the nameless. And if you name it as being the nameless, you have named it, which is always a problem when you're talking on this level. It just becomes very hard to say anything because we're trying to point to something beyond words. But the very nature of what it means to be beyond words is also something we're calling into question. And actually, I think that's a really fundamental point. It's going a little bit outside the reading, but let me try to give you a sense of that. The thing about going beyond language or beneath language or not relying on names and concepts, that's very important to the TSK vision and to what we're trying to do, and it's a way of connecting into space, which is the theme really, this nothing that matters. But we have this tendency to think we already know what that means. And what we imagine that it means is, and I realize I'm just putting words into your mouths here, so you may not all agree with this, but I'm giving you my sense of how people tend to think about these things. We tend to think that there's this realm which is not shaped or defined by language. That has to do with pure experience, and that has a transformative impact when we contact it. And I'm not saying that's wrong exactly. I mean, I'm not saying it's wrong at all, but by putting things to ourselves in that way, we create this realm, we name this realm. And this is one of the things we will get to in the reading. How do you avoid that, or is there any possibility for a nameless that is not, that doesn't occupy the realm of the nameless, which would be another name? I'm still kind of trying to play with this paradox or point it out, and let it be clear, or shed some light on it. I don't know about making it clear exactly. But shedding some light on it, and it's really important. So I could try to go on about it for a little while, but I think instead let's just go to the reading because the theme comes up, and when it does, I'll probably point back to it again. We'll see what we have to say. So Rinpoche starts off by taking his discussion of the field communique and applying it to names and concepts and words, right? He says, names and concepts is where he starts. They identify qualities, and then the qualities are referred back to entities. And he says, the more words we have, the more qualities accumulate. First of all, it's important to see that this point that he's making, which is that it's not that we name things, which is kind of how we usually imagine what we do, right? He's saying that things are kind of the carriers for qualities. I probably shouldn't use the word carrier because he uses that later in the chapter in a different way. But, you know, what we really experience is qualities. So let's say really experience. What does that mean? It means through our senses or through our thoughts, perhaps. That's a whole other question. We experience, you know, the examples, the kinds of examples he gives here. Let's see. Well, actually, yeah, shape, color, solidity, those all have to do with sense experience. Ways of interacting, that's an interesting one. You know, the quality of a particular way of interacting. In each case, it's qualities. And then after that, you get to things, you get to entities. And that's going to be important, that distinction. I mean, we'll see one of the reasons that I think that Rinpoche wants to be sure we're clear that there's this kind of two-step process, you know, from names and concepts to qualities, and from qualities to entities. Although, that's not quite the right way of saying it either. I'm sorry, I'm being a little complicated this morning. I hope it's clear. Just something about the way I woke up, I guess. Names and what was wrong in what I just said is you could say, well, you start with the qualities, and then you apply names and concepts. That's also not quite right because the qualities come into existence, you could say, on the basis of the names and concepts. But still, you could say, let's try to make it as general as we possibly can and say something or appearance presents itself. You know, there is the present, as Rinpoche said in the last chapter. And through names and concepts, we kind of sort that out into qualities, and then the next step, which is absolutely one that we can't help making, is we turn those qualities into entities. And that's how we get to the realness of experience. That's how we get to a world and ourselves in that world and the logic that makes sense of that world. Those are all things that Rinpoche talks about on this first page of the chapter. So names and concepts, qualities, entities, and then we need to kind of add to that picture. Actually, Rinpoche does a very interesting analysis in the second paragraph that we just can't go into. It's a whole other thing, it seems to me, where he's saying, here's how it happens. You know, first this happens, then that happens, and we could look at all of that, but one could look at all of that, but we're not going to because it's just a whole other topic. But what he does say is, you know, there is a world which comes into being, so you could say that's the next step, right? Names and concepts identify qualities which are referred back to entities, and on the basis of those entities, a world is set in place, and that world has its own logic. It makes sense in a particular way, for instance, in terms of cause and effect, one aspect of it. And it also, that world includes us, you know, because we're part of the world. We're part of what shows up. So our identity comes into being also. So it's this very complicated thing, and it all kind of refers back to names and concepts and qualities. So one question to ask here that may help specify or clarify that, I see that Tina's talking about a technical difficulty. I'm hoping that Kathleen is working on it. But it might have to do, who knows? I'm hoping Kathleen's working on it because I'm not going to address it. Oh, Tina says it's fixed. Very good. Maybe I can speak a little louder or get a little closer. Okay. So maybe it's because we're talking about such profound and esoteric things that language won't support it, that my voice cuts in and out. I don't think that's it, but maybe. Okay. The question that I was going to go to has to do with this relationship between names and concepts and then qualities. If you didn't have names and concepts, would that mean that there wouldn't be any qualities? That's what the reading seems to suggest. And so let's entertain that. Excuse me. Let's entertain that for a moment. What would it mean if there were no qualities? I mean, obviously, you know, that whole sequence that we just went through would never happen. You wouldn't, you know, if there were no qualities, you wouldn't get any entities. If there were no entities, you wouldn't get any world. If there were no world, there wouldn't be a logic to that world. If there were no world and no logic that supports it, we wouldn't arise. It seems like, you know, everything, absolutely everything, would be wiped out. So the suggestion here it seems to be that it's all based on names and qualities, or a concept, names and concepts. So one question to ask yourself is, what would that completely different world be like? That world in which there are no qualities, you know, would that be a nothing? You know, we're talking about why nothing matters. And the question is, so is that the nothing that we're pointing to? Is that, you know, do we kind of have it within sight? I mean, obviously not within sight because it's nothing and we can't see it. But are we kind of sniffing up the right trail? sorry, I'm just entertaining myself. Are we sniffing up the right trail? Well, I think we need to keep that open. We don't know yet what the nothing is. It certainly seems likely that it's going to be related to the nameless that Rinpoche talks about in this chapter. So you could say a world without names and concepts would be nameless. Well, okay, that makes sense. In fact, it's obvious. But what would that nameless world be like? That's, you could say, what we are exploring. And then underneath that, there's the question, since we are asking ourselves about nothing and space, is that the same as this nothing of the nameless? So those were just questions. I'm not wanting to answer them. I mean, I can't answer them, but you know, we just need to be aware that we're entering this world in which it turns out, in the sense, you could say, there's different kinds of nothing. You know, once you get beneath or beyond names and concepts, everything becomes really hard to get a handle on. A little bit like black holes, I suppose. I mean, Rinpoche is very fond of black holes. I mean, he likes the idea very much. And you know, from time to time, I've heard conversations where he talks with people who are more knowledgeable about these things than I am about black holes. Or he'll ask me something about it, and I'll say, I don't know. And then the conversation moves on. But he's very interested. And in a sense, you could say that you know, this idea of the nameless, which might be nothing at all, might be the same as nothing at all, or might be different, might be related to space. We're not exactly sure. Are there different kinds of nothing? Is nameless the same as nothing? Okay, those are the range of questions. And I'm, you know, we've probably spent enough time trying to clarify what it is that we don't understand, which can be a very useful exercise. But let's move on a little bit. So what Rinpoche says here is, you know, once we are in the realm of names and concepts, we're kind of going back into that realm. So we did a little bit of we tried to imagine letting all of that drop away, and then we end up saying, we don't know what to do with that. It's like, you know, what goes on in the black hole? We have no idea. So let's go back into names and concepts. That world, our ordinary world, the one that is established, Rinpoche has been at pains to show us through names and concepts. And he basically says, as soon as you're in that world, everything kind of emerges together. The logic, the self, the world, the entities, the qualities. It's all this big interdependent, if I can borrow a term from Buddhism, it's all this big interdependent whole. So there is something about that, you know, that we need to now turn around and apply to names and concepts. because the point that Rinpoche makes in the middle of page 20, the first full paragraph on page 20, he says, it would be misleading to say that the real substance of this constructed world, the world that we live in, we just have been exploring how it's constructed, it would be misleading to say that the real substance of this constructed world is words and images and concepts. I mean, that seems natural in a sense, right, to say that, because we start with words and concepts. Where do they come from? Well, that's what he's asking now. He's saying, you can't say that they're basic because they're part of what emerges too. Right? Words and concepts are also products of the communique, he says. They're patterned responses to sense data, feelings, associations, and the pool of previously accumulated words and images. So we're not saying that the origin of everything is words and concepts, because words and concepts are just part of what shows up. They have a particular role to play. Okay. And what he really says is, at the end of that paragraph, in the middle of page 20, he says, you know, it's all just one big circle. We can't really ever get out of it. It's like playing with a deck of cards, is the image he uses, which I think is a nice image. You can make up all sorts of games. You can deal yourself all sorts of different hands. There are incredible number of permutations and possibilities, but it's all just playing with a deck of cards, you know. And that's kind of what our reality is like. And names and concepts are like the deck of cards, you know. You could try to work out that image, but I don't think I will. So Tina's asking the question, don't we need names and concepts and stories? Don't we need to know, isn't it more important, I'm going to quote her, to know that this is what they are and use them as such? Yeah, I think that's really where we're heading. I think that Rinpoche is not saying you should abandon words and concepts, although we need to look at that more carefully, because he kind of considers that possibility within the reading that we had for today, and I do want to get clear about that. So yeah, I think you're asking a good question, and at the conclusion you draw, you know, we really need them and can use them, I think is very consistent with what Rinpoche says. But let's look at how that gets developed so that we can kind of appreciate the significance of it. Okay. So he introduces this word that I mentioned earlier, the word carriers. He says you could think of words and concepts, or here he says words and images and their associated concepts. So that introduces another level. I won't try to say anything about that. He says, well, you could think of them as being the carriers of the communique, right? They're bound to its mechanics and dynamics. I'm reading at the bottom of page 20. They transmit old knowledge forward. And that's another way of saying that they're given by the communique, but they have this particular role to play. They're the carriers of the communique. And then he starts to make a different shift. He starts to make a really, really interesting and important shift. So at the very bottom of page 20 and then on to page 21, he says, you know, words are carriers of the communique, and that means they seem to be completely bound to what's communicated. You know, they're the ones that communicate it, but what they can communicate is completely shaped by what's been previously communicated, what's presented, and so on, all part of the same picture. But, he says, you know, that's not a complete account, because Words and images and concepts can evoke new knowledge and inspire a new vision. They can touch the heart and stir the spirit. And that is so important. And I think so important to the vision. You know, one of the questions that people raise about TSK sometimes is they say, well, you know, this sounds kind of like a certain, you know, spiritual teachings or mystical teachings, and, you know, talking about going beneath the level of what's named and presupposed, and there's something more fundamental, and we touch this quality of intrinsic being or the essence of being. And I'm not, you know, putting that down. I'm just saying, you know, people say, well, isn't he really pointing toward that same thing? And if so, you know, why does he have to use so many words? You know, he's written all these books. And Rinpoche says in Love of Knowledge at a certain point, he says, you know, there's a sense in which words can't ever get at whatever it is, this nameless, let's call it for now. You know, words can't get at the nameless for obvious reasons, you know, because they're names. So why so many words? And I think that the answer, or a version of the answer, is what he says right here. He says, words can evoke new knowledge, they can inspire new vision, they can touch the heart and stir the spirit. And TSK is a wonderful example of that. You know, sometimes, or is the fundamental example of that, for our purposes. But you could also point toward poetry, you know, or anything that really moves and touches us. So Michael is asking a question. I said that if we try to name the nameless, it seems to be hopeless by definition. So it's a paradox. And Michael says, well, but paradoxes can be resolved by stepping outside the realm in which the paradox appears. And so I'm going to read what he says. Listening to you struggle to find words. Right, that's my job in life. I struggle to find words. Listening to you struggle to find words. Wads, he says, but that may be an esoteric term that I don't understand. Listening to you struggle to find words. I am able to step outside and listen as if your efforts are swimming in a realm that doesn't need names to be present. Well, that's an interesting image. It feels somewhat like standing outside and looking in at the paradox without being bound by it. I think that's good. I'll let that stand without saying too much about it. You know, this is in part, you could say, a paradox, and yes, it does seem as though there's a way to step outside it. Does that mean we've stepped into the nameless? Well, that's part of what we're investigating and asking about. Okay, so Rinpoche makes this interesting move where he says words are not the villain here, right? They're the carriers for the communique. That doesn't make them the villain either. That's just the role they play. But beyond that, words could be, you might say, words could be the heroes, right? Words could be not just words, but he did use the word images here. We could find a way to, let's just say, to communicate something differently, right? Which is not the same as saying moving into a different communique or moving into a different field. That may happen. That's a possibility. And one of the things about the way Rinpoche presents this is, you know, these three levels. I think mostly you're familiar with that. These three levels of time and space and knowledge, and you could say there's this second level at which the field communique could communicate a different field, and that would be very interesting. Right? So it relates to a question Tina asks here: are there really different realms? Well, there may be different field communiques. That would be a way of thinking about that. So words might lead us to a different field communique. But that's not necessarily what we're talking about here. Let's keep going and see where this takes us. So he says something very interesting, right? And there's a kind of implicit question here. The question is, if words have this special power that he's suggesting, and I said, if you don't think of TSK as the example, you could think of poetry. If you don't want to confine it to words, you could think of works of art, visual images or music, although that might, music might be going to a different level, but anything you could say that in effect names something, and you could name without words, that's all I'm suggesting. If words have that power, where does that power come from? That's the question that he's asking. Why do they, how do they come to have that capacity? And he answers that question. He says it's because of their role as agents of the communique. So before he said carriers, now he's saying agents, which suggests to me a little more power. It's like they've been deputized. They're authorized in effect by the communique, and that's where they get their power from. That's kind of what he's saying. The power that enables, and I'm about four lines down on page 21, the power that enables words and images to establish the forms of our reality is the power of the communique. And he suggests that we can access this power directly. So we could access it through words. That's part of what we're talking about, right? The power to inspire and to evoke new knowledge and touch the heart and stir the spirit. All of that can happen through words, but it could also happen in a very different way. And we haven't talked yet about what that different way is. But he's saying when we access the power of the communiqué, this is very interesting. We understand that what is identified as real is more accurately the outcome of an act of projecting. And so this relates to the comment that Tina made a little right toward the beginning of our discussion here in the chat. When we understand the nature of the communique, that understanding is a way of accessing the power of the communique. And there, just to be clear, I think this is obvious, but the communique has this incredible power. It's like saying, there's this very basic question that gets asked sometimes in philosophy, why is there something rather than nothing? And it's a very fundamental question. And I just leave it to you to kind of reflect on it. In effect, this asks the same question, not quite at the same level. And in fact, the way it answers the question or addresses the question may suggest that way of asking it isn't quite right. Why is there something rather than nothing? But it is asking that question or something very similar to that question, and it's giving an answer at the same time. It's saying the field communique has this power to through its carriers or agents, names and concepts and images, it establishes a world, it establishes a reality, it establishes us as within that reality. And so the question becomes, instead of asking, well, how can we get behind or beneath the field communique, or even in Michael's terms, how can we step outside it, we can say, well, what if we understood more directly, more immediately in our own experience, how the field communique works? I think that's where Rinpoche is taking us. So he's exploring that question. He's saying, how can we activate this understanding? It's the second paragraph on page 21. How can we activate it and let us understand, let it guide us? And first he talks about creativity, and he talks about great artists and poets and writers. And he says, well, that's good. They can do that. Let's say that they can do it. We certainly have some sense that they can do it. But we can't all do it, and they can't all do it all the time. So there's a little clue that something is possible, But he basically is saying that's not the answer. You know, let's not stop there. You know, and all say, well, let's go off and be artists. You know, we'll form an artist commune
I
and
like that.
yeah, well, that's a possibility. You know, it's
I'd really
open.
love that.
It's open, but that's not what he's suggesting. So then he goes on to suggest another way. That is that we could cut through the verbal, right? And we could turn to experience directly. So this is what I was talking about earlier, the beginning of of our session today. You know, a lot of people would say that, well, stop all these words, you know, just forget about it. I mean, yeah, sometimes they're powerful, but mostly they just obscure things. Let's just go to pure experience. Let's go to immediate experience. Okay. It's a possibility. And he acknowledges that. He says methods are available for activating a different kind of awareness in which we note qualities, characteristics, and interactions without assigning them back to objects that possess them. Now notice that he's only taking one step back. You know, we looked at how there's, you know, names give you qualities, qualities give you entities, entities give you a world which appears to a self. That was kind of the dynamic, the unfolding, the genesis of what we ordinarily experience. And he's only cutting out the last few steps. He's saying you could go to the qualities instead of the entities. Right? And that would be more powerful because somehow, you know, it seems as though naming has more to do with entities, with things, than with qualities. Not completely, but, you know, a good example, not the one that he gives in the book, but a good example is if you say, well, if you're, you know, people who are trained enophiles, I think is the word, they're professional wine tasters or wine gourmets, and you know, they struggle to find words to describe the taste of wine because, you know, it's because words are not very good at naming qualities. They're much better at naming things. You know, you say this is a 1967 Cabernet Sauvignon from such and such a vineyard. That's all about the thing, and it's easy to have words to name that. And then if you try to describe the taste, it's much more difficult. So one way of going behind words, he's saying, is to go back to qualities. Clearly, that's going to be a kind of a limitation because qualities are still part of the communique. But that's not really what he talks about here. He says, he gives an example. You know, so I'm going to, this is a spoiler alert. I'm going to read you a sentence, but I'm going to tell you in the beginning what the end of the sentence says. It's about a rose. He says, we might identify a red color, a specific shape and texture, and a pleasing fragrance. So those are qualities, right? Without making the normal connection to the name rose. So what he's saying is, if you want to go beneath the level of words, go beneath the level of entities. And just go to the qualities, and you have gotten at least part of the way, and that's a way of going to a kind of more direct experience. He raises this interesting question at the very bottom of page 21, that even the naming tendency, you know, we wouldn't have to real attention to it, or its conclusions, and that's actually quite important. But he only mentions it in passing, so I'm not going to deal with it right now. So he does say something here about this that, you know, I mean, I said that there's a problem because qualities are still related to names and concepts, and we've talked about that. But that's not the direction he takes. So before we look at what he says, let's take a look at what a couple of comments or questions. Tina says, immediate experience still loops back to labels and names. And yeah, that's exactly what we're talking about, is that you know, we could say, oh, well, it's the quality of the experience that matters, not the thing that I experience. You know, It's the rose and not the name of the rose. But it seems like we're still at the level of qualities, and that means we're still connected in some way with labels and names, words, concepts, and so on. Yes. I guess Tina, you're our busiest correspondent here, and you're asking about qualities. I think we've actually given a lot of examples of qualities. Maybe not the most subtle examples, but the ones that are easiest to understand, perhaps. I think that's fine. Okay. So the move that Rinpoche makes is a little different. He says, you could do this, and this would take you, at least to some extent, beneath the level of concepts and names and words. But it's hard. But it's very difficult. And I think basically what he's referring to here, I could be wrong, I think what he's referring to is meditative traditions. He's saying few people are going to be able to master this approach without extensive effort. So it's a kind of an unnaming, right? A reaching back to a level that seems to be more in touch with an immediate experience, despite the problems we've pointed out there. Says, that would really be very hard. And he asks the question, which I think is a really fundamental question for the TSK vision, because I think it's what Rinpoche is pointing toward. When he talks about a new vision of time and space and knowledge, he says, can we only invoke new knowledge through such exceptional means?